Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right, from the BBC. Artwork that was looted by Nazis 80 years ago was spotted in an estate agent ad.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, and we should maybe translate estate agent ad to MLS listing.
Right.
It was stolen by the Nazis from a Jewish art dealer in Amsterdam, and now spotted on the website of an estate agent selling a house in Argentina.
Oh.
More than 80 years after it was taken.
How did it get there?
Well, I'll tell you, because the picture is called Portrait of a Lady. It's by Giuseppe Ghislandi. And yes, in fact, the whole property was once owned by a senior Nazi official who moved to South America after the Second World War.
So it wasn't a secret. Like, everybody knew, oh yeah, that guy was a Nazi in that house.
Oh yeah, and not only that, the painting was not a secret. It features on a database of lost wartime art, and it's linked. You can actually go to the database and see this photo in black and white saying, this is missing, it was stolen. And then you can go back to the BBC article and be like, here it is in color. Oh my goodness. And this is just one artwork among hundreds that were looted from art dealer Jacques Goudsticker. Now, unfortunately, he died at sea, escaping the Netherlands, and is buried in England. But post-war, some of the works were recovered in Germany and put on display in Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum as part of the Dutch National Collection. Now, Goudsticker's sole surviving heir, daughter-in-law Marie van Sacher, took possession of 202 pieces in 2006. But one painting, a portrait of Contessa Colleoni by late Baroque portraitist Giuseppe Ghislandi, remained missing. So there was an investigation that unearthed wartime documents suggesting that it was in the possession of one Frederick Kajan, an SS officer who fled to Switzerland in 1945 before moving to Brazil, then Argentina, where he became a successful businessman.
Mm.
He also was described as a snake of the lowest sort.
Mm.
That is a quote by American interrogators. Now, the paper said it had made several attempts over the years to speak to the late Nazis' two daughters in Buenos Aires about their father and the missing artworks, but didn't really get replies from them.
Hmm.
However, the reporters had a really good stroke of luck when one of Kajian's daughters put the home once owned by her father up for sale with an estate agent specializing in expensive Argentine property. And another looted artwork, a floral still life by the 17th century Dutch painter Abraham Mignon, was also spotted on one of the sisters' social media.
Oh, so, all right.
One of the sisters even told a paper, quote, I don't know what information you want from me, and I don't know what painting you're talking about.
Okay, yeah.
The one I pointed at in the picture.
Yeah.
Yeah,
all right.
They don't know it. They don't know it. They don't know it. It's the Mariah Carey gif. I don't know her. Mm-mm. Lawyers for Goudsticker's estate said they would make every effort to reclaim the painting. We wish them luck. Quote, My family aims to bring back every single artwork robbed from Jacques' collection and to restore his legacy.
Has Argentina gotten any better? Like, we've got an extradition treaty now, or what the equivalent for property. We're going to actually go in and take this.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think so, but I don't know.
According to this article, it doesn't sound like it.
Right.
But, you know, they were great businessmen, so it may be that what they brought to Argentina was worth flouting a little justice. Who knows? The cycle continues.
Well, or maybe it's just a way to make your house listing go viral. Because people on Zillow do that. They're like, oh, let's put a bunch of haunted dolls in this house because it'll make people share the listing online.
Yeah.
Maybe she's just trying to sell the house for more.
You know, that giant Costco teddy bear only works if you're selling like a middle class home in Nebraska. But if you're selling an XSS estate in Argentina, you got to bring out the big artworks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You just got to know your audience, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Live Science. It's titled, Spiders Seen Keeping Fireflies as Glowing Prisoners That Draw More Prey to Their Webs.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah. clever, but also grim. For the firefly, great for the spider.
Oh, God. I mean, the firefly gets to live a little longer, I guess.
Maybe they can, like, Morse code, like, stay away.
Right, yeah. Right.
So, sheetweb spiders found in subtropical forests of East Asia normally sit in the dark, waiting for prey to approach. Footage captured by the researchers showed that if another insect, such as a moth, is caught, the spiders eat it immediately. But the fireflies were left up to an hour before being consumed, which is about the same amount of time that a female firefly emits a glow in a fixed location. Most of the captured fireflies were male, which the authors say may indicate males mistook the stationary glow for potential mates. The researchers think the spiders, unlike other sit-and-wait predators that have developed their own bioluminescence, like anglerfish, have worked out how to exploit fireflies' sexual cues to their advantage. Lead author Yimin So, a researcher at the Tsinghua University, said, "Handling prey in different ways suggests that the spider can use some kind of cue to distinguish between the prey species they capture and determine an appropriate response." The team developed a series of field experiments, placing LED lights resembling fireflies, and left other webs empty as controls. The LED webs attracted 3 times more prey than the empty webs.
Whoa.
Yeah, like it really works really well.
Yeah.
For me too, that's crazy, because it's not like, they're all doing it, right?
Yeah, well, it's pattern recognition, because it's like you catch one, and if you don't happen to eat it right away, all of a sudden you got a bunch of extra food, and that sort of cause and effect that even a spider can figure that out is a little terrifying, to be honest.
I just kept getting the image of, like, I don't know, maybe it was from the movie Beetlejuice, where he's got the, like, live ladies, like, all glowing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Super, like, everybody's drawn into it. So I don't know. It's like the intrepid businessman of the spider.
Yeah.
You know what I've just realized? It's the marshmallow test. Because if he doesn't eat the firefly right away, he gets 2 fireflies in 5 minutes. Ah, okay.
Wow.
Spiders are better than toddlers.
Okay.
But we knew that.
Well, yeah, probably.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from waxy.org. Will Smith's concert crowds are real, but AI is blurring the lines. So I don't know if y'all have seen this. It's been going around like crazy.
Yeah.
Wait, he's in concert again?
Oh, yeah. He's been making a lot of music.
Huh.
Oh, okay. So he's on the post-slap rebound tour.
Yep.
Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
And it's mostly global, for what it's worth.
Ah.
That's where most of his concerts are taking place. But there is about a minute-long clip of a Will Smith concert that's been blown up online for all the wrong reasons. Because it looks like he's using AI to generate fake crowds filled with fake fans carrying fake signs. And in the last week, it's been covered by Rolling Stone, Vibe. I mean, pretty much everybody's covered it. But what I like about this article is he goes through it and kind of shows what's actually going on. There are some wonderful pictures in this article. And if you see the pictures, they look bad. They look like AI slop.
Hmm.
Uncanny features, multiple limbs and fingers, nonsensical signage. So there's one where it looks like from West Philly to West Swiggy with 2 G's.
I don't know. He gets swiggy with it, right? Yeah.
He does get swiggy with it. But this is where it gets complicated. The crowds are real. Every person in the video started out as real footage of real fans, and these were sourced from multiple Will Smith concerts during his recent European tour. The main Will Smith performance in the clip is from the Positive Festival held last month in Orange, France. And there's a link to a phone recording of the audience, so you actually see there are people there. And it's intercut with various shots of audiences from other festivals, like the one in Switzerland, the one in Belgium, and some few others. And here, the signs which were previously distorted can now be read, like the one that actually read from West Philly to West Swizzy, 2 Z's, which is short for Switzerland.
Oh, okay.
Honest mistake, really.
So what happened? The author believes Smith's team generated several short AI image-to-video clips from professionally shot audience photos.
Ah.
Smith's team also uploaded the same video to Instagram and Facebook, where it looks considerably better than the copy on YouTube. Turns out, for the past 2 months, YouTube was quietly experimenting with post-processing YouTube Shorts videos.
Oh.
And I also heard about this from guitarist Rhett Scholl. He posted a great video about it, where he talks about another guy that I watch, Rick Beato, his videos looking like AI, and we all know Rick would never do any of that. So a few days ago, YouTube finally confirmed it was happening. YouTube's creator liaison, Renee Ritchie, posted on X, "We're running an experiment on selected YouTube shorts that uses traditional machine learning technology to unblur, denoise, and improve clarity in videos during processing, similar to what a modern smartphone does when you record a video." YouTube is always working on ways to provide the best video quality experience possible and will continue to take creator and viewer feedback into consideration, as every single creator that this has happened to has hated it.
Yeah. I mean, that's ridiculous, because like when you use your phone and it's got its like crisp image function, it's not adding extra fingers. It's not messing up. I don't believe them. They're lying.
Right. It's legalese. What is the difference between generative AI and image enhancement technology? We don't have a definition of that right now.
Yeah.
But for all the things we can dog on Will Smith for faking his crowds, it's not one of them.
Yeah. It wasn't his fault.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. This next one is from SciTech Daily, and it's called "The Unexpected Reason Baboons March in Order."
Oh.
So as the title implies, animal researchers have long noted that baboon troops, which is what groups of baboons are apparently called, will, when moving around from one area to another, always travel in long lines. And that's not especially unusual. There's a ton of animals that do this pretty much worldwide, including zebras in Africa, but also wolves in North America, for example. But researchers have also determined that different species do it for different reasons.
Yeah, the British can't help queuing.
Right, exactly. Their reasons are very different, as we'll learn. So when prey animals do it, for example, it's usually for protection of the herd, which means putting the most vulnerable members in the middle with stronger members at the front and back. When zebras do it, on the other hand, all of the strongest animals jockey for position at the front of the line because for them, resources are actually a bigger concern than predators, and being at the front gives them better access to any food or water they might come across. Other animals, meanwhile, seem to be working on a social leadership philosophy, where those at the front are making real-time decisions about where the herd is going to travel, and the rest are just following the highest-ranking member of the group wherever they may go. And when it comes to baboons, social dynamics did seem like the most promising explanation, because of course we know primates are very social creatures with complex relationships, but it also didn't entirely make sense, because baboons don't migrate in random patterns. They usually follow a few set paths back and forth between established areas for eating, sleeping, etc. So every baboon in the group definitely already knows where they're going to go when they set out, and they don't need decision makers. So a team at Swansea University decided to get some concrete answers. Using high-resolution GPS devices, they tracked each individual member of a troop of wild Chacma baboons in South Africa's Cape Peninsula, observing 78 travel progressions over 36 days. And what they found, according to Associate Professor Andrew King, is that the pattern is not for protection and not based on resources and not even really based on social dominance. Instead, they concluded that baboons just really like to walk next to their friends.
Aww.
Aww.
Sometimes a particular animal would be at the front of the troop or sometimes the back, but no matter what, it would always be nearest to the specific baboons that it socialized with the most. And so the researchers say that this actually represents an entirely new reason to walk in a line that hasn't yet been proven in any other animal, though of course I think it's fair to suspect that it may be true for other primates at least.
Mm-hmm.
Most importantly, it means that the line itself does not serve an evolutionary purpose. There is no benefit to walking in a line for baboons. It's merely a side effect of a different evolutionary benefit, which is their social bonding in general.
Having friends.
Right, exactly. And so just to pat themselves on the back a little bit, the authors of the study have come up with a new term to describe this concept, which they're calling a social spandrel. And the etymology of that is that in architecture, a spandrel is the slightly rounded triangle shape that's formed when two archways are placed side by side. So someone who doesn't know about structural math might think the triangles are important, but in actuality, they're just a side effect of the arches, which are doing the real work. So at some point, that word spandrel got appropriated by biologists who use it to mean a genetic trait that arises not because it was selected for, but simply as a side effect of something else. So now these baboon researchers have declared that baboons walking in a line is the first known example of not a genetic, but a social spandrel. Which is all fine. You got to classify your stuff. That's what scientists do. But it does feel to me kind of like they're trying to dress up their conclusion a bit, because otherwise it's a real duh kind of moment. Like, they have friends. So do we.
I was watching something and they were talking about chimpanzees, right? Which we share 98% of our genes with. Like we're closer related to chimps than chimps are to apes. And the one thing that struck me as a that they noticed it was there were two chimps walking, again, one behind the other. And when they asked the conservationist, you know, who are they? What are they? One of them was older. And then the one behind him following was a younger male. And apparently in chimpanzee culture, you learn by just following around the most aggressive male on how to act.
Right. He was the nerd at the school who was like, hey, can I help you out and carry your football for you? All right. Next link.
Next link.
All right. From JSTOR Daily, we have a wonderful piece on the wonderful world of the water ski. So it is a relatively new American invention in the world of performance and competition. Most folks trace the origin of the water ski to Lake City, Minnesota, where a teenager named Ralph Samuelson put together some makeshift and ridiculously heavy wooden skis and decided to try hanging on for amusement and dear life behind a 24-foot speedboat in 1922.
He was a teenager, you said, when he did it?
Of course.
That tracks. Yeah.
That tracks. Minnesota curator Sandra Rierson explains that, quote, despite broken skis and several failed attempts at getting on the water, on the third day, Samuelson successfully rode the water of Lake Pepin aboard a pair of 9-foot-long pine planks from the local lumberyard. He had softened and curved the tips of the boards using his mother's wash boiler and reinforced them with metal tips. Now, 3 years later, he greased up a homemade wooden ramp, 4 feet wide, 16 feet long, and landed the first water ski jump. Now, if the Minnesota thing threw you off, fair, but the Midwest continued its pursuit of water ski showmanship, notably through Wisconsin's Tommy Bartlett. But it was really when the sport took off in Florida that it became a cultural shorthand for mid-century American pageantry. Now, as for Florida, they went through a boom and bust cycle in terms of development and tourism in the 20s. But the state was, and still is, vulnerable to things like hurricanes, housing shortages, fruit flies, which sounds kind of silly until you think about how much the citrus agricultural industry means for them. They also had banking busts. So after a real estate collapse in 1926, basically nobody was bullish on Florida, and especially not central Florida, as the railroads bypassed most of the state and just funneled the tourists directly to coastal cities like Miami, Tampa, and St. Augustine. But when tourism started to recover in the 30s, even though it was during the Depression, there was an entrepreneur named Dick Pope who saw an opportunity and he capitalized on it. He founded a park and a vaguely Venetian-style pleasure garden in what they call Winter Haven, and he opened this business in 1935, calling it Cypress Gardens, which became very well known for a variety of entertainments, many of which emphasized conventionally beautiful women.
Oh, yeah. It was Swamp Hooters, is what it was.
Well, in part, but before we lay all the blame on Dick, it was really his wife, Julie, who ran the park while he was serving in World War II. She's the one who zeroed in on Southern belles and bathing beauties to bring off-duty soldiers into the establishment.
All right.
So a historian credits Julie with introducing these iconic, showy skiing displays. So in 1947, barefoot water skiing premiered at Cypress Gardens, and Dick Pope Jr. was featured performing this new feat on national newsreels.
Performing this new feat?
Oh!
Sorry.
It was beautiful. Now, this combination of thrills, athleticism, and lithe beauty was just a near instant success. The February 1947 edition of Life magazine proclaimed that, quote, in any Florida season, two of the surest ways for a pretty girl to get publicity are to become citrus queen and to be photographed on water skis. Oh, such an innocent time. But the performances became showier and more complex over time, including coordinated costumes, pear stunts, and perfectly posed pyramids. And in addition to the pure entertainment factor, water skiing telegraphed a particular image of ideal femininity, a carefree sense of performative American prosperity. Commentary on their performances generally emphasized beauty at the cost of minimizing their incredible athleticism. Because you need to be really athletic to do this. I have tried
water skiing. Yeah, I've seen some of it. They're holding on to it with their feet, doing amazing, ridiculous
things. And making it look so easy.
So easy. So fun. Making it look fun. And it's not.
So it became this emblem of a certain kind of squeaky, clean breed of American pop culture. And Cypress Gardens held strong as a little piece of escapist paradise well into the 1970s. But by that time, they were far from the only game in town because they had SeaWorld, Walt Disney World, and Busch Gardens, who had their own water skiers, right? So the Popes sold the Winter Haven Park in 1985. The property changed hands a few times before finally becoming part of Legoland's Florida location.
And let's be real, it was the Fonz that killed it.
Yeah, I mean, he's the one who tried to make it masculine with a shark, and everybody knew that wasn't the real deal.
Well, actually, that may be the way to bring it back now, is to make it extra mask and extra sharky. Sadly, the water ski show closed for good just recently, December 2024, with one final show on New Year's Eve. But who knows what new developments will come about. I'm thinking of like bioluminescent waters.
Yeah, I mean, if synchronized swimming is an Olympic sport, I feel like pyramid water skiing should be an Olympic sport.
Right?
Because like you said, it's acrobatic. It's hard. It requires a lot of muscle control.
And not only that, if you're doing it with pairs or in groups, if you deviate and hit someone with your skis, the whole thing, it's like dominoes.
Right.
Like
right.
You have to have so much precision. And if you watch some of these older videos, they are so close to one another, just smiling and looking like it's just real easy.
You're going to eat an apple pie when they get done.
That's right. Next link.
Next link.
This is a short one coming to us from BBC titled Taco Bell Rethinks AI Drive-Thru After Man Orders 18,000 Waters. So Taco Bell is rethinking its use of artificial intelligence to power drive-thru restaurants after comical videos of the tech making mistakes were viewed millions of times. In one clip, a customer seemingly crashed the system by ordering 18,000 water cups, while in another, a person got increasingly angry as the AI repeatedly asked him to add more drinks to his order.
They're just following instructions.
Yeah. It's like the two sides of the coin. And I watched the clip of the 18,000 water cups thing, and it didn't really crash. I mean, there's clearly a person there monitoring the system because it asks him what he wants. He says, can I get 18,000 waters? And then it just goes, oh, like it's going to say, okay. And then it cuts out and somebody's like, hello, how can I help you? Like a human came on and was like, could you please just stop?
Right. I don't get paid enough.
Yeah. So since 2023, the fast food chain has introduced the technology at over 500 locations with the aim of reducing mistakes and speeding up orders. But the AI seems to have served up the complete opposite. Taco Bell's chief digital and technology officer, Dane Matthews, said that deploying the voice AI has had its challenges. He said the firm was learning a lot, but he would now think carefully about where to use AI going forward, including not using it at drive-thrus. We'll help coach teams on when to use voice AI and when it's better to monitor or step in. But despite some of the viral glitches facing Taco Bell, it says 2 million orders have been successfully processed using the voice AI since its introduction.
Well, some of those people drove away and just didn't complain. That happens to me a lot.
Well, and clearly the guy ordering 18,000 waters is trying to break the system. It's a form of protest, which I don't disagree with. I think you should absolutely be putting these things to the test and showing them that it isn't magic. And a normal person can go, yeah, no, I'm not doing that, buddy. Like, it's very easy.
Yeah, the amount of accents out there, too, still.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You get a range at Taco Bell.
You get a range. And drunk people, too. I want that. You can't. I mean, that takes a human to interpret what's
those
going
are the
on
edge
there.
Cases.
I don't know. Taco Bell, it might not be the
true,
edge case.
True, not an edge case. Yeah, it's like a 20% case.
Right.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from Vice, and I know we've talked about it a little bit before, but science finally proved it. Your dog really does feel what you feel. So scientists have spent years confirming what people already know. Dogs have a freakishly good sense of what we're feeling, not because they're psychic, but because their brains have been fine-tuned over thousands of years to decode ours. In a brain imaging study, dogs showed activation in regions similar to our own when hearing voices. Not just any voice, but human ones with emotional weight, a laugh, a sob, a pissed off yell. According to researchers, these sounds light up their auditory cortex and amygdala, the brain's emotional command center. They're not just hearing us, they're feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
The face you make when you're on the verge of a breakdown, dogs notice that too. Aww. Studies show that they react more intensely to familiar human faces than strangers, and their reward centers actually light up when they see yours. So when you walk through the door and they act like you're a celebrity back from the dead, yeah, they mean it. You are.
Right, right.
And then there's the oxytocin loop, a literal chemical bond that spikes when you and your dogs lock eyes. Our dog is really good at this. Researchers have compared it to the gaze between a parent and an infant. Wolves don't do this, but dogs evolved to look at you in the eye. And I know also, like, don't look a dog in the eye. That's situational.
Don't look a wolf in the eye, for sure. Yeah. But if they're giving you this, like, you know, the puppy eyes and that little angelic gaze, they're looking to establish some good connection.
And they can smell your emotions. So in one study, dogs exposed to sweat from scared people became visibly more stressed than those who smelled happy. So if your dog seems on the edge, relax, take a deep breath.
Yeah, check your own behavior.
I think the dogs need to start taking some responsibility. Why don't they breathe calmly? And then I won't be as stressed. You know,
well,
like this could go both ways.
That's kind of what we got with our dog. We call her our first best defense against depression because she is so sweet and so loving that if we do catch her kind of mirroring what we're putting out, it's a good signal for us. And she's also just beaming so much just waggy, happy, lovey joy at us that it is a good like anchor to get us out of whatever funk we're in.
My dog mostly needs to pee in the middle of the night. That's what she's feeling. And I'm irritated, and she can tell.
But are you sure you don't need to pee as well? And that's
maybe
just her way of saying, hey.
Hey, you're getting older.
It did occur to me the other day, like the dog was waking me up for no reason. And then later my husband was like, oh yeah, you were like talking in your sleep, like moaning like you were having a nightmare. And I was like, well, then why didn't you wake me up? Like, why do we need the dog to protect
well,
me from
Well, husbands
this?
Have yet to develop that degree of sensitivity that the dogs have.
That's
but,
right.
You know, a few more centuries.
His amygdala is just not as developed.
Nope.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include Secrets of a Pickpocket Detective, The Forgotten Plague That Almost Destroyed America, and Why Haven't Quantum Computers Factored 21 Yet? So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInterestingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.